Every time I started a company, it was more like an MBA. I think every startup right now has the responsibility to make a positive impact, being part of the positive change. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense to start for me.
Welcome to Speak Like a CEO. Oliver Aust and Lena Carlson chat to Waldemar Zeiler, founder of Einhorn and author of Unfuck the Economy. Waldemar shares his perspective on the future of business, sustainability, and how business and politics collide. Enjoy the episode.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Speak Like a CEO. My name is Lena Carlson, and I'm here with Oliver Aust. Hey, Oliver.
Hey, Lena. Our guest today is Waldemar Zeiler. He's the founder and chief executive unicorn of Einhorn, and he's written a new book called Unfuck the Economy. Hello, Waldemar.
Hi.
Thanks for talking to us today. What was interesting when I read your book is that you're not an activist. You're actually a serial founder and CEO. So how come you wrote a book like Unfuck the Economy?
Yes, I actually don't like the term serial founder. I prefer it in Germany. I say Serienscheiterer. It's much more fun. Yeah, what would be the English word for it? Serial failure? Or
I'm not sure the serial failure is the right, captures the spirit of Serienscheiterer. I think it's about, you know, you set up your first company when you're 19, and I think it's 7 companies, and not all of them went that well, I think, judging from your book. So maybe just talk us through what do you mean by that?
Yes, I'm coming from this world with venture capital, and everyone's just raising money. It's mostly young men from elite universities, and they are starting these companies, and everyone wants to have that kind of title. It's like serial founder, and it's all about just raising money. Nobody talks actually what happens with the companies, and nobody talks about how many companies actually fail as like it's a natural process. And maybe that's in the US, that's fine. But in Germany, it's like nobody's allowed to talk about failures. That's what I'm making fun of it and saying like, no, I'm Serienscheiterer. Maybe in the US, this wouldn't be a huge thing to say, but in Germany it is. So yeah, trying to be provocative sometimes.
Isn't there this thing, right, that like the most successful founders are likely to be second or third time founders?
Yeah, and also the average age. Like I used to look at the stats, like about really talking about unicorn founders. So, and I think their average age is like 42 or something. So, and they must have done a lot of things wrong before that. It's not always just the young Zuckerbergs who start this kind of companies. They're much older and have failed a lot before.
Yeah, and I think it depends on how you look at it, right? Is it a failure or a learning or a growth experience? So maybe you can elaborate on how you feel about it. And in particular, then I'd love to know a little bit about Einhorn, which I think kind of took the world by storm and suddenly captured the attention of a lot of people.
Yeah, I'd love to. Well, for me, like, of course, it's not a real failure for me. I don't think there are failures out there. For me, like every time I started a company, it was more like an MBA. And sometimes venture capitalists paid for it. Sometimes I had to pay it myself. But yeah, there was like, I learned the most from every startup. You had to be really dive into a different field and become an expert within a couple of months. I'd love that. And failing for me was also always part of the process. And yeah, what to tell about Einhorn? We unfucked condoms, I guess. And now we unfuck menstruation products. And now we're trying to unfuck the economy. And maybe one day we will unfuck the world, or at least contribute a bit, I hope, at least.
Sorry, so maybe to clarify for listeners, when you say unfucked condoms and menstruation cups, what exactly do you do?
Condoms, vegan condoms. So we're producing vegan condoms, mostly for the German market. And also we have a range of menstrual products like tampons and pads and cups, menstrual cups. Yes, and they're all, of course, we try to make them all fair and sustainable. We call it Fairstainable. Right now, we're actually in a crisis, actually figuring out what we are. It's not that easy because we thought we were a company. But now we do so many different things that we're actually not that sure anymore. So we're in a certain purpose crisis. So right now we're trying to find out what's actually our purpose as a company. And that's a very interesting process.
I'd love to dive into that in a second. Just maybe from my side, Einhorn is the branding and design, I think, for a product that maybe hasn't had a lot of innovation or interest in doing something new in the last few years. You guys seem to do that really well. So it's interesting to hear you now say that you are entering some kind of crisis mode or thinking about your higher purpose as a company?
Yeah, I mean, like looking at the products, it's like that. Obviously, our products are completely different. If you're in a drugstore, in a supermarket, and you have a look at the shelf with our products, you will right away identify our products. I'm not telling you how they look like, so listeners have to walk and figure it out themselves. But they are completely different. That's also part of the unfucking of design. For example, condoms are a medical product. So everyone is actually marketing that way, and it's like in a box that could also just be some pills in it. But we said, like, why? I mean, it's a lifestyle product. It's about sex. It's a very sexy thing to do. Why do you market it as a medical product? Doesn't make sense. So we switched it around, and, for example, our condoms you buy in chips bags or in crisp bags. And the same goes for the menstrual products. And, that's what we mean. What we think is unfucking by design, but also unfucking about the value chain. For example, so we said, like, we can't actually produce or launch products which are worse than the products on the shelf already. So, and especially on the sustainability side. So we do, for example, life cycle analysis of the products, and we see, like, okay, how much of negative impact do our products have? And we don't launch new products unless they have a better impact than the already existing products. And that's another field of unfucking. And then we're, of course, dealing with products who are associated with taboos. So, for example, for condoms, it's sex, or for menstrual products, it's periods. And we're trying to communicate through our products. So our tampons, for example, it says tampons in, Nazis out. For example, on our condoms, there used to be like these cookies spells, or how do you say it in English? Like this cookies, fortune cookies. And they have like text on the back. And there are funny things in order to loosen a bit the situation and being not that tense when you start having sex. And so all kind of little details, and we became more and more political. And that's the fun thing, because, like, when we started the company 6 years ago, we said, like, one thing we don't want to be is political. So, and right now we're doing a lot which has to do with politics, and that's also why we're trying to figure out actually what's our purpose. I mean, we're acting a lot like an NGO, but we're financed by products. So right now we're in a crisis.
But how do you see that developing? I mean, that's a really interesting touch point you're at in the development. Are you going forward as an NGO with attached products? Are you still a product-driven company with a purpose? How do you see this play out?
Yeah, actually, I have no clue, because there's no role model for that. I have a good feeling about it that we're going to the right direction, and there's just no examples for that, but doesn't mean that it's right. And we have to figure it out by just walking further in this direction. I mean, basically, it's like, if we're looking at the situation, and today, I don't know when you're going to broadcast that podcast, but I mean, we had the elections, and we still don't know who's going to be the US president. And this is the craziest in time. We're in a lockdown in Germany. We don't know who's going to be, if it's going to be Trump or Biden. We have the climate crisis. So, like, everything, like, the whole world seems to be crashing, and I'm supposed to sell condoms. This doesn't make sense. I mean, it's like pushing now and using a lot of my time to sell more condoms or expanding to different countries would feel totally, I don't know, this doesn't make sense to me at all. And I have like a 4-year-old son, and when he's asking me like 10 years later, Dad, what were you doing 10 years ago when the world was crashing? I was like, yeah, I was selling tampons and condoms. This this just doesn't make sense. So that's why we're like figuring out how can we, like, you need money to pay your rent. We're happy that we have the products so we can have salaries, but we have also more and more time to use it for different projects. The world needs a lot of people who are taking care also of projects which are actually benefiting the world and not just their wallet. So, yeah, we said, like, okay, we can actually do it. What hinders us not to be more engaged in all kind of political and societal projects? It's actually nothing. So we said, like, okay, then we have to do more and more of it. And to a certain extent, people don't know that. So we also got shitstorms for doing political stuff, because they said, like, well, that's just greenwashing, you know, or purpose washing or whatever, because companies used to do that. They do just a bit of donations, but they fuck up the world in total. And then they just focus their PR on the little projects they did. So it's weird times, and we have to figure out what we are, and we don't know yet. But I feel very, very, like, I feel on the right track for finding that out.
This touches on some really interesting points that I think lots of people are thinking about right now in terms of, like, okay, what the fuck am I doing in 2020 when it's been such a wild, unpredictable year? And lots of stuff has completely flipped itself over and is not looking sustainable anymore. And it's kind of a question of, like, do you keep going with what you're doing, or do you try and do something else? And having that kind of pivot moment, I think that's really cool that you as a company and with your employees and your co-author have kind of taken that on as a mission. How does that, I guess, play out in terms of communications then? So how do you kind of flip that story for yourself to say, okay, this is what I was doing and this is what I am doing now? Because I guess that's probably something that's also a little bit hard to clarify.
Well, at the end, what counts are deeds, really. And when we started the company, like, also many people said, like, yeah, that's a nice try and you're promising a lot, but are you really walking the talk? And now, like, 5 years later, we have, like, we've done the steps we could. We've learned a lot. I'm a different person than I used to be 2 years ago or 3 years ago or even 1 year ago. And we're learning. Basically, that's it. And we're trying. Like, I know that there's much more stuff I don't know than I know. Yeah, we have to experiment. And we will get shitstorms. We will get criticism. That's all fine. But we're here to learn. And there's nobody who's got the answers. Like, I really like Rutger Bregman. I don't know if you know this author. He's a Dutch historian. And he said, like, usually, like, in mankind, we always had a vision of the future. So there was always a utopia, which we strived for, a better life or whatever. And now we live in times where we don't see utopia anymore. Apparently, we've reached a certain level and we have enough, or most of us have enough food, at least in the north, in the global north. Yeah, we don't know what's actually ahead of us, what kind of future, like, should we aspire to? And we're really lacking a utopia. So we have to find out what utopia is right now. And we have to do lots of experiments. And that's also part of the DNA of our company, is basically doing a lot of experiments, because nobody knows what, like, a good future will look like. So we have to try and figure out and fail a lot. And that's what we're trying with the company. And I'm very privileged, because, like, I have, like, a unconditional basic income from the company, and I can focus a lot of time on actually finding out and talking to a lot of smart people, much, much smarter than I am, and trying to connect them and learn from them and building up new networks. And this is the most exciting job I ever had in my life.
The book you refer to there is called Humankind, and I can, you know, I agree, it's probably the best book I read all year, except for yours, of course.
Oh, thank you.
Talking about your book, you just to the point you just made, you launched the idea of a fair sustainability, which basically captures the idea of a purpose economy. How do you see that sort of, you know, our whole economy transitioning from sort of smaller islands like your company to for the whole economy to move towards this fair, sustainable model, which I agree with would be the optimal outcome? And I like how you put forward the idea of just fair play in business, fair play in the economy, fair play in international relations. And maybe that's the utopia we should be striving for, that humans come first, the planet comes first, and then we all play fair and by the rules.
Yeah, the fun thing is, we take it as a given, where we live in, what kind of principles we are following, business principles, or like even relationship business principles, religious principles, and like the economic idea, the one we're living right now, and also which has led us to the problems we have, it's not that even that old. Like, for religious stuff, you could say, like, it goes like thousands of years or hundreds of years back in history, but it doesn't for the economic one. So basically, what led us to all the problems is like the credo of Milton Friedman and his boys gang, of optimizing shareholder value only. And that used to be a pretty radical idea 50 years ago. And then all of a sudden it shifted, and like policymakers and Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, and so on, they started listening to this guy and his in his boys group. And now we're like seeing the consequences, what has led to that. And now we must be ready for new ideas and say, like, okay, that was a radical idea back then. We tried it. and we see the consequences, and it was just a shit idea. I mean, it's not Milton's fault. At that time, he thought that's the right thing to do, but now we see the consequences. So let's be open for new radical ideas and stop what is actually pushing the other crises, like the biodiversity crisis or the climate crisis, the inequality on Earth, and like all the attacks on our democracy, which have also partly to do with business. So, like, really being open for radical ideas. And I've actually wrote down a couple ideas, which are crazy and radical, and also that's also why it's called a Streitschrift. Basically, we have to argue, and we have to argue about different ideas, but we have to accept that what we're following now leads us into disaster. So, and this acknowledgement, like, has to come actually basically from the people with power, but they have like most to lose, so they don't want to do it. So that's a bit of a question mark we have. How do we do it? It's like in French Revolution, we know all how this ended, and we don't hope it's going to end like that. But like, how do you do it? How do you tell somebody who's got all the power, like, dude, you have to give up power and share it? And I know you had a great fun the last couple of decades, but now it's messing up our world. And it's like also in the book, it's mentioned, like, how do people with power react? And the prices in New Zealand, for example, for bunkers, that the right English word for bunker?
Yeah, bunkers. Yeah,
bunkers. So they really buy bunkers. You hardly find any bunkers anymore in New Zealand, because they say, like, okay, world is going crazy. We have to fly from Silicon Valley right to New Zealand, and that can't be the answer. I mean, you have to be part of the solution and not just buying a bunker. Yeah, but we have to try a lot of things.
I don't hate the idea of bunkering down in New Zealand. Probably actually a nice place to watch the rest of the year go down. But back to the new ideas. You mentioned earlier to Oliver and I that when you were writing the book, you really tried to, I guess, break outside of your bubble, which I think is something that everyone's a little bit guilty of right now, is sticking inside that bubble, whether that's, you know, in person or online. So how exactly did you go about getting out there and looking at different ideas and perspectives and things that are not within your own circumference?
I think, like, actually I shouldn't have written that book, because I was busy co-organizing the biggest democracy festival in Germany, which should have started on the 12th of June this year. Obviously, it was cancelled due to COVID. So actually, I was busy organizing that democracy festival with lots of volunteers and activists. And that was the first time really we got outside of our economy bubble, where we said, like, okay, we want to provide a platform, the biggest stadium in Berlin there is, with 70,000 people. And we actually want to celebrate scientists like rock stars. And we want to provide the stage for NGOs, for scientists, and get the message out there and actually destroy wrong narratives. And tell new narratives about possible utopias ways. And so that was already, so I was already talking to lots of scientists and NGOs and people who worked in political institutions. And so all was building up and the whole stuff. And then the stadium, the event got canceled. So it had to get out somewhere. So that's actually when I used that time during lockdown really to write this book and bring all the stuff in there. And that's also why the book is mentioning with solutions, for example, the presencing, the U theory from Otto Sharma, which is like an MIT professor, or Maya Goeppel, who is a scientist from Scientists for Future, or Claudine Neert, who is working for Mehr Demokratie, an NGO focusing on more direct democracy in Germany for 30 years. And yeah, in talking with them and like really leaving your bubble as an entrepreneur, as a founder, and talking to them actually made us all feel like, yeah, that's what has to happen. We have to really leave our bubbles and bring our skills and strengths together. For example, like organizing such a stadium, we did a crowdfunding. We raised more than 2 million euros in ticket sales. Something like that has never been done. And this is like where we could contribute with our entrepreneurial skills, providing the stage for them. But we could have never provided the content for the stadium. So, and that's where they all came in. So, yeah. And basically that was only with that with that happening, I could actually write that book. And then it's not all only about the economy, but I really try to show the bridges between economy and all the crisis we have at the moment.
Yeah. You mentioned the event at the Olympic Stadium, which you talk about in the book as well. Apparently there was quite a lot of backlash against it, which is very surprising. But how did that feel? I mean, when you go all out to create something of value and crowdfund and get 70,000 people together, and then sort of there's this shitstorm of people criticizing it, apparently haven't really looked into the idea closely. So how did it feel, and what did you do about the media and the backlash out there?
We were not prepared at all for that. So like I felt totally destroyed. And because like the first 5 years of Einhorn, we only got good press and we're like the startup guys and it's cool things what we do and sustainable startups. But then apparently we crossed the line doing into politics somehow. We didn't even know. So we just continued with what we always have done. Then we're all of a sudden perceived completely different. So there were like even I didn't even understand like what's wrong when I talked to critics. We wanted to know. We also changed a lot of things. But they told us like it's always very suspicious if entrepreneurs come into politics and tell you that they know the answers. They have so much experience and they do everything different. So some of them even reminded of Trump. I mean, we don't look alike, but we had to understand that we really crossed the line and we have to be much more. We had to understand that. And for me, it was one of the greatest learning curves in the last couple of years. And sometimes learning always sometimes it comes only by pain. And we suffered a lot. It was like crazy. And but we also grew. And I think you have to withstand shitstorms nowadays if you want to change anything in the world.
How do you respond to some of those accusations that were maybe coming your way? Because I'm guessing, or it sounds like you kind of had good intentions going into the political realm, but obviously were met with some backlash.
Well, first of all, we had to understand because we really thought it's the best thing ever. We couldn't even think of arguments why this would be a bad idea, and only later we understood. Yes, I mean this is okay that people actually thought it's not such a great idea, and it's because we had a huge stadium. I mean, it's not a meeting with 10 people, but we have a responsibility. If we rent such a big location with 70,000 people, and one of the problems was that that the principles of crowdfunding are very new to this field, because we said hey, we're going to develop the program once we rent the space. So we didn't provide any program. We just said we're gonna deal with a huge crisis we have on Earth, but we're gonna develop the program together with scientists, NGOs, and so on. So, and of course, for the other people, it's like wow, they're gathering 70,000 people in a stadium in Berlin where even Hitler used to talk, and they're not telling us what they're talking about. This is suspicious. And so the next time, of course, we would do a lot of things different.
What would you do differently?
We would involve many more NGOs and people, and we would challenge the whole concept by different parties. And it's really difficult as an entrepreneur. You can't listen to the critics too much, because every new idea can be criticized to death and you don't start at all. So to a certain extent, entrepreneurs have to say okay, I'm not listening, I'm just going to do it. But in that field, it doesn't work exactly that way. To a certain extent, yes, you have to push for it, but you have to get many more people on board, because it's politics and democracy, it's about many people, and you have to look for consensus. So we would involve much more people than now.
What would your advice be to new founders right now who are starting to build up their business, and how to kind of encompass this social responsibility into what they're doing as well?
Well, first of all, really do an analysis if your product really improves anything. And every company has a negative impact, and we should just be aware of that. And you should check if if your negative impact is much higher than already available products, then I would just not do it because it's stupid. Like maybe in 10 years, if we've solved all the crises on Earth, fine. but actually, like every business founder should do a life cycle analysis of the product and say like, okay, what kind of impact do I have? Of course, you can start with CO2 because that's the one we know most about. And you can calculate that and make sure you have none at all possible. Yeah, and do something with purpose. I mean, it always depends on what kind of time we're living in. And we, I think, live in a very special time. So also the startups which are starting now shouldn't be so dull and boring like they used to be. So I think every startup right now has the responsibility to make a positive impact and being part of the positive change. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense to start for me.
You mentioned in the book that you really value storytellers and that storytelling is key to changing, obviously, the narrative in public and politics. Obviously, the book you've written is a fantastic platform to go out and tell that story. What are your plans for the next few months? Do you want to speak to a lot of journalists? Do you want to be on TV? Do you want to see an English edition of the book? So how do you want to tell the story going forward?
I have no clue, actually. For me, it's like even for me, it's a weird situation anyways, because I wrote the book like six months ago. And now it's a promo tour of the book. And I'm like, I'm already with my head somewhere else. Of course, it's still connected to the topics in the book. But talking about the book, I had to get used to it. And now I'm doing it because it's important. But of course, we're already working on different projects, which could be the successors of the Olympia Stadium. And we're trying to find the right usage for our time as a company, but also as individuals. And so yes, I'm not planning on a second book. Maybe I'm going to write one at one point if it's contributing to the topics which we're working at the moment currently.
How was the process of writing a book for you and getting it published and actually finding a publisher? I know we just went through a very similar process with Oliver putting out his third book, so it'd be interesting to hear from your perspective.
I mean, actually, it's like my co-author Katharina. She's been she's been with the Einhorn story, and she's been reading my posts, my LinkedIn posts, and watching my Insta stories about unfucking economy and Einhorn. And she always said, because she's an experienced author, she's like, hey, why don't you write a book about it? And I never took it so serious because we always had other things in our mind. But during lockdown and after the event got canceled, I said like, okay, let's just try. So basically she just wrote a two-pager based on talks I gave and speeches and so on, and she gave it to her agent, and her agent actually said like, well, it's actually a good idea. And I'm like, yeah, whatever, because I had no clue. I'm always starting like 100 projects at the same time, so sometimes I don't even keep track, and so I actually wasn't expecting so much. And then the author, the agent, sent it to different publishers, and apparently there's some kind of an auction then starting if you have a good, like a topic people want or publishers want. And like 4 hours later, our publisher, Goldman Verlag, wrote back right away and said like, okay, don't go into auction. We want that book. We want that story. Start writing, basically. I'm like, okay, so now I have to write a book. Okay. And they said like, okay, let's maybe next year. So we're going to launch it next year. I'm like, no, we can't. We have to do it this year because we actually took on so much taxpayers' money at the moment to rebuild an economy which is crashed by COVID. And if we launch it next year, then we have no chance like actually being part of the discussion where the money goes. So all the topics actually have to be put out now to actually being able to influence somehow. Maybe we also don't influence at all, but at least having a chance of influencing, we need to publish it now. Yeah. And so they said, okay, then you said it in the beginning of July, please hand over the book. And yeah, I was writing like hell.
Cool. That's awesome.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, timing is everything, isn't it? And you're very timely with the book coming out in October.
Yeah, for sure. How was it with you? Like, what's your process?
The process was also similar in the sense that Corona opened up a lot of time slots, and I sat down and said, okay, how can I help people who are affected by the crisis? And obviously, when you look around, a lot of good people, as freelancers, small business owners, etc., have been affected by this epidemic and no fault of their own. And obviously, I thought, okay, maybe with my knowledge of, you know, how can you communicate in a crisis, I can help some of them. So I started to write it all down, and basically I spoke it. So rather than sitting down and writing a book, I spoke it, which became the first draft. Obviously, then, as you know, you have to sit down and really work on it. And it was a fantastic team effort with Lena and the rest of the team. And we managed to put it out in a similar quick fashion in October. So, we also thought it's all about the timing, and we want to be part of the, maybe not part of the public discussion as much as sort of helping individuals we knew and hopefully getting it into the hands of many people.
Well, let's wrap up almost. I guess maybe just your final piece of communications advice.
Well, be honest to yourself.
Yeah.
Like, if you're honest to yourself and then you also communicate what you find out, that's going to be of interest to everybody.
Excellent. Valdemar, thank you so much. I mean, for everyone out there listening, if you speak or read German, Unpack the Economy by Valdemar Zeiler is a fantastic book, great contribution to the debate where we are at. I hope there will be an English translation at some point, but if not, hopefully this podcast has given you some insights into what's in the book. Valdemar, thank you so much, and thank you for listening.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much.